Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Of course, you know, we Zoom this show on Tuesday, so if something should happen Tuesday night, we will not be talking about it. We begin our show every day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vidman when he testified before the impeachment hearings of 2019. Again, I keep thinking about the fact that he kept telling his father he was so glad that he'd moved to America and that it would be okay. And what we have learned over the course of the last couple of years, if not the last 48 hours, is that it is less okay by the minute. Donald Trump, I think, is just desperate to declare martial law. But let's hear the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vidman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States, so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear, for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I went to the New Republic and I saw an article at the New Republic by a guy that I love to talk to because he's a great economist and a great teacher. Dean Baker is joining us. He is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. His area of expertise is housing, consumer prices, intellectual property, Social Security, Medicare, trade, employment. What's left, Dean? Anyway, the title of your piece was Building an Economy That Works Again, a Practical Blueprint for Reform in the Wake of the Coronavirus Shutdown. And obviously, everybody is concerned about what's going to happen after coronavirus or even with coronavirus still sort of lingering around because we either don't have a vaccine or we haven't figured out some kind of medication or we have a second wave and we're even less prepared or it morphs. I mean, there's so many unknowns out there. But your piece is so interesting because it didn't address the economy issue in a way that I had predicted. So I want to welcome you to the program. And then I want you to sort of talk a little bit about how you begin your piece. And of course, one of the things I keep thinking about is that it does sort of predicate itself on the fact that we probably don't have Donald Trump in for another term. But then I'm also sort of frustrated because I'm not sure that a President Joe Biden has the capacity to do some of the things that you suggest. But why don't you hold our hands and walk us through what we sort of normally think are the ways to rebuild an economy and what you actually know that is sort of the missing piece or sort of under the radar, but yet in the fact is one of the biggest drivers for the inequality that we see today, an economy that isn't working for all of us. So welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Arnie. It's always great to be on your show. So I appreciate that introduction and try to make it as simple as possible. It's standard for many of us who consider ourselves progressive to think, okay, here we have this big problem created, inequality, poverty, of course, racism, all these big problems that are created by the market. And we need the government to step in and do things like provide free college, like provide universal health care, Medicare for all. A longer list, and we all know what those things would be. And those are all great things. So I'm not saying, you know, if we can get those, wonderful. But the point of my piece is that we have to understand that the inequality, the extreme wealth, extreme poverty that we see, that wasn't just given us by the market. It was by the way we structured the market. And what I focus on in particular here are government-granted patent and copyright monopolies.
And let me read a sentence to you because I think it's really important as people hear you begin to talk about this. And I want to talk about it from a Democratic perspective because you say the Democrats, you know, if they win in 2020, will feel a need to protect the interests of ordinary workers. But this is where I'm so concerned, but they too are most happy to ensure the wealthy are not harmed, since the rich contribute to politicians in both parties. So really what you're talking about is that you're looking at the government that is in a lot of ways, you know, on one hand, the progressives want to protect workers, but you're pointing out that it's been the government that's enhanced the incredible wealth and opportunity for the very rich. So if you really want to protect workers, you better tackle what the government has done to enhance the wealth of the very rich.
That's exactly right. And, you know, again, I focus on patent and copyrights. There are other things I mentioned here in other of my works. But just because this, one, it's a huge issue, and two, it's just so blatant. So people often think about patents, copyrights, that those were given to us by God. And you go, no, these are very clearly created by the government. They've been changed by the government. They could be made longer and stronger, as has been the case over the last four decades. And there's an incredible amount of money at stake. And in that piece and much of my other work, I focus on the case of prescription drugs, both because obviously, this is hugely important. People need them for their health, for their life. Comes up with the coronavirus. We're going to have a vaccine. Obviously, people need that for their treatments. People need those. So it's health and life. And it's an incredible amount of money. We're going to spend over $500 billion this year on prescription drugs. And I try to always put things in context. So $500 billion, how much is that? It's about 2.2% of the economy, or if you like another metric, the entire food stamp budget. We often have big fights in Washington over food stamps, $70 billion. So this is seven times as much as the entire food stamp budget. Right. And the other point about there being a lot of money there is the reason we're spending $500 billion as opposed to, say, $70, $80, $90 billion, you know, maybe 20% as much, is because of patent monopolies. Because almost invariably, drugs are cheap to manufacture and distribute. So the reason that Pfizer and Merck and Gilead Sciences and the other big drug companies can charge us so much for these drugs, tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands, is because they'll arrest people. They'll have people arrested if they try to produce it in competition with them. So my point here is this is a really bad way. I mean, anyone will be listening to this and go, well, if we didn't patents, who'd do research? Well, the government pays for a lot of research. We could pay for more research. We don't need patent monopolies. So one, if we got rid of the patent monopolies, drugs would be cheap. The other thing is, if we had the funding up front, and we're seeing some of this with the coronavirus, if you had the funding up front, you could share all the research. So we'd have people collectively working. It's a common problem. Think of developing treatments. Think of developing a vaccine for the coronavirus. This is a worldwide problem. What we should want is researchers in Europe, in China, in Japan, in Korea, the US, wherever they might be, sharing their findings as soon as possible so that other researchers could build on them so they don't pursue dead ends. And then whenever they develop something, there wouldn't be a patent on it. It'd be cheap. It'd be like the polio vaccine, which is a fantastic story. Jonas Salk did not patent the polio vaccine. So all of us, when we were little kids, our parents were able to afford it even if they weren't rich. It was cheap.
So let me ask a question, Dean, because you talk about drugs. So one of the things I always hear is that we know that drugs are ridiculously expensive, which is why, you know, Bernie Sanders always wants to go to Canada to buy his drugs. I look at the cost of drugs in other countries around the world, New Zealand, Europe. I mean, the same exact drug is significantly cheaper. How come the patent law doesn't apply in New Zealand or in Canada or in other places? Why is it us? I mean, it would have to be the same drug. I would assume there would still be some sort of patent control. I know that that's one of the biggest fights with China is about intellectual property. So just explain to me a little bit about why, if what you are saying is true, and we were able to somehow either shrink the number of years or get rid of the idea of patent, why is it, even with this patent law in effect, why are drugs so much cheaper in Europe and in other places around the world, and we are always paying top dollar, sometimes 10 times, sometimes 100 times more? Why are we triply screwed?
Well, that's a great question. And again, it's an incredible story in the sense that they do have patent monopolies in Canada, in Germany. So most of the drugs that we're seeing patent protection for in the US, they're also subject to patent protection in Germany and Canada. They aren't necessarily in India. India is much stricter. So there's a lot of drugs that we give patents to that they don't. So drugs are even cheaper in India. Oftentimes just 1% of the price of US drugs. But the reason they're cheaper in Canada or Germany is the government limits the price. So we get this perverse story where we tell a drug company, we go, okay, we're going to give you a monopoly on the drug. No one could produce in competition with you. We'll arrest them if they do. And then you get to charge whatever you want. We're the only country in the world that does that. And then you get this absurd argument where if you try to put price controls on like they do in Canada or Germany, somehow you're interfering with the free market. And, you know, it has me pulling out what hair I have left going, what do you mean the free market? You gave them a monopoly. That's not the free market.
Wait. So you're telling me so that the difference isn't that there still is this patent in other places around the world. The difference is we gave them sort of an opportunity to write a blank check, whatever you want to charge. Those other countries, although they still recognize the patent in those other countries, they have established price controls. So those drug companies have to either say, I'm not going to sell in Canada, I'm not going to sell in Europe, because you're going to tell me that I can only sell for $10 as opposed to $200 in the United States. And they're going, we'll sell it for $10.
That's basically the story. Because, you know, again, they aren't losing money at the prices they get in Canada and Germany. They wouldn't sell there if they were losing money. So they're covering their costs and they're making a profit on it, but obviously not nearly as much as they do in the US, where they might charge 2, 3, 4 times as much. And again, if you didn't have the patent, it would be even cheaper. So some of the drugs, I forget whether I mentioned this in that New Republic piece, but there's a very important cancer drug, Gleevec, that when it was patented, I won't get into complications with it, but its price was over $100,000. You had a high quality generic version that was selling for around $1,000.
Oh my God. So Dean, let me just ask a question though, because is your suggestion to get rid of patent? Is your suggestion to shrink the time that the patent would apply? Is your suggestion to have say, okay, you got a choice, patent and price controls or no patents? I mean, what is it that you want, that you think could be accomplished? Because the only concern I have, and I'm going to go back to the sentence that I read at the very beginning of this interview, the Democrats will feel a need to protect the interests of ordinary workers. Ah, but they too are the most happy to ensure the wealthy are not harmed. Well, the wealthy are the big, you know, pharma CEOs and pharma execs and the lobbyists for big pharma. And I'm just trying to figure out, how do you approach patent law knowing that the deep pockets are controlled by people who are definitely advantaged by what they're able to do with patents? How do you somehow begin to get the American people and even the Democratic Party to sort of a come to Jesus moment that if you don't do this, you'll always be fighting and actually reestablishing the inequality that you claim to be concerned about?
Yeah, it really is a change in thinking. And I should point out, with prescription drugs, I think patents are particularly harmful. So, you know, my view, and I write about this in my other work, I wouldn't necessarily get rid of patents in other areas. They're less harmful, less consequential. I mean, I think patents in general need reform, but they're nowhere as bad as in prescription drugs. With prescription drugs, I really want the government to take over the funding. Now, that doesn't mean that the government does the research. So we could even pay Pfizer. I'm fine. They could make a profit, pay them to do the research, pay Merck to do the research. But the point is, you're getting the government, we're paying for it up front. The condition of getting the money is, one, everything is fully public from day one. And two, when you have a patentable drug, it's in the public domain. It's a generic. You already were paid for the research. We don't have to pay you a second time with the patent monopoly. And in terms of trying to make headway on this, to say we're going to do this with the whole drug industry overnight, okay, I've been around Washington long enough, that's not going to happen. But can you say, with something like the coronavirus, where we actually are putting up a very large share of the money directly, we're going to put it all up. Tell us what you're spending, you know, and we'll audit it. So don't tell us you spent $50 billion, you know, and have nothing to show. We'll audit it. You know, tell us what you're spending, put it in the public domain. And then when you have a vaccine, it's generic. It's whatever, you know, a treatment, it's generic. And if you could show examples like that, you know, I've often said, you know, if the next great cancer drug, instead of costing $100,000, cost a few hundred dollars, well, that's going to be hard then for Pfizer or Gilead when they come up with their next drug. Go, oh, but this one's $100,000. You just need a foot in the door.
And what you're saying is that the pandemic is giving us the foot in the door. that we now have an opportunity to do the explaining like you're just doing right now, to be able to show why the kind of sort of open source concept works, why it's essential. And if it works for the COVID-19, it should work for cancer. And if it works for cancer, it should work for, and so what you're hoping is kind of like the domino theory, that once you explain it in one setting and people see that it means access, it means less cost, it means that more people can feel secure in knowing that they can acquire it, then you're going to say, so what's different about COVID-19 than when your kid gets a diagnosis of cancer? What's different about that than some other illness that they could get? And as a result of that, it will empower the Democrats to be able to say, oh, this is a good thing. And at the same time, you're also saying to people who are ridiculously rich that you're making money not based on a market principle, but because we have protected you to make this ridiculous amount of money and to sacrifice the health and well-being of everyone else.
That's exactly the point. There's an old expression about facts on the ground. So, you know, we could have this argument abstractly about, oh, you know, is it a good idea to have patent financing or public financing or whatever? We could have that and they could say, oh, it wouldn't possibly work. But when it works, you can't say it couldn't possibly work.
Exactly. And you're looking at this coronavirus as kind of being, I mean, there is an upside to this, because it really is making us more aware and feeling a greater sense of vulnerability. And it's not just, and it isn't just in pockets. One, it's global. But two, it has such a dramatic impact on the economy, a dramatic impact on school, that now people are more sensitive and more aware.
That's exactly right. And again, so much of the funding is already public. So it's not as though, you know, I have to be, oh, you want to spend all this money on researching cures that could, well, we are spending a lot of money. I just want to make sure that when they do that, it's public research, and then whatever they get's in the public domain. So we don't have to worry. We don't have to beg the drug companies, oh, price it so we can afford it.
Right, exactly. You want to say something, Ken?
Yeah, getting back to what you were talking about earlier about the drug companies, I know there's an answer to Milton Friedman and the free market economists, but if we set caps, government price limits on the price of these drugs that they're ripping us off, if we were just like Canada, they say, well, we wouldn't produce the drugs. If we can't price gouge and have a monopoly and, you know, charge like we used to charge for AIDS treatment, we just won't make it available. We'll buy it up and hoard it. They will limit production.
Yeah, but Ken, they're in the business of selling drugs. What if they're suddenly going to have price limits on it, and they're not going to sell drugs? They're going to go out of business. Am I right, Dean? I mean, you got a choice.
No,
you want to make your drugs or not make your drugs.
They could make the threat, but they're in very few cases, particularly with the U.S. I mean, they could tell a smaller country, they could tell New Zealand that, hey, you know, that price, no deal. You know, we just won't sell it to you. They aren't going to be in position to do the U.S. Now, there is a grain of truth to their story in that argument, in the sense that suppose we paid them the same price they pay in Canada or Germany. They say, oh, we'll spend less on research. That probably is true. You know, so it doesn't mean they'll spend zero on research, but will they spend less? Yeah.
Hold on one second. Dean, aren't they spending a lot of money, though, on advertising? Aren't they spending a lot of money on lobbying? I mean, when you begin to look at how much money they're actually spending on research compared to what they're now doing, in order for me to watch some couple, you know, walk down the sandy beach and talk about some drug that I never even understand, and I know I need a script to get it anyway, like, why are you selling me something on television that I need a script for? I mean, when you actually look at where their money is going, their money isn't going into research, it's going to CEOs, it's going into marketing. I mean, that's part of the problem, is suddenly they may have to be forced to do what they actually claim they're doing, which is spend the money on research.
Yeah, no, they spend, you know, roughly 14 cents on a dollar on research. But also it's important to point out, you mentioned the marketing. Well, this is again one of the perversities of the patent system. They have an incentive to market their drugs in contexts where it's not useful. And we don't have to look hard for examples. You know about the opioid crisis.
Exactly.
Well, a large part of the opioid crisis is that you had Purdue Pharma and the other companies, they lied. They were pushing them to doctors by saying, oh, this new generation of opioids, it's not as addictive as the prior generation. So it's a great pain reliever. They knew that wasn't true. At least that's what's been argued, and they paid a lot of money about in court cases. So they wouldn't have that incentive. If there was no patent there, if no one sent, you know, anyone's going to market their product, you know, someone that sells paper cups. I always use the analogy because paper cups are cheap. People make money selling paper cups and they say, oh, our paper cups are great. Okay, but they're not going to lie to get people killed so they could sell more paper cups. There's not that much money in it.
All right. So one of the most important things I thought as the end of your piece was that as you were talking about this, what you really were talking about is looking at wealth before taxes, not the wealth after taxes. And what you were really saying is that what we really need to do is begin to sort of recognize that if all this money is going into the CEOs and the very wealthy, that means that money isn't being shared by sort of the rest of the workforce. And therefore, the inequality begins at the pre-tax. You could go after the fact and tax 90% of a billionaire's income. The question people have to start asking is, how the hell did you get to the billion? I mean, yeah. And your point is, rather than fight the fight after, with the tax fight, why don't you begin to ask the question, how did all this wealth go to the 1% and why wasn't it spread around in the first place so that we have to even think about the whole tax question?
That's exactly right. And my poster child who I mentioned here is Bill Gates. And I know Bill Gates has done useful things with his philanthropy. But the point is, he's one of the richest people in the world. He has over $100 billion, last I checked. And the reason he has that is because he has a copyright and patents on Microsoft software. And if he didn't have those, you know, my joke, maybe it's no longer true because he's getting up in years, but he'd still be working for a living. You know, the reason he is incredibly rich, I'm sure he's a smart and ambitious and hardworking guy, so I'm sure he'd do fine even in a world without patents and copyrights. But the reason he's incredibly wealthy is that we gave him patent and copyright monopolies that allowed him to get incredibly wealthy.
So Dean, who gets this? So I love this article. I mean, I really did, because it really did take my mind out of it, sort of rearrange it and put it back in again. So we're going into 2020. We're going to see, I always say Joe Biden, you're going to hear me say this a million times, Joe Biden leads from behind. So I'm trying to figure out, so who is the champion? Who gets it? Who can explain it in English? Who can connect what happened with the pandemic and if we come up with some kind of a medication or whatever? Who can explain this to people so that we give Joe a little bit of cover, because he comes from that place where he wants to hold hands with the very wealthy, you know that. But at the same time, if he needs to fix it, because we don't just have a pandemic that we're going to have to pay for, we're going to have to pay for climate change. We're not going to have to just pay for climate change. We're going to have to pay for whatever the economic, you know, failure that we've been experiencing for the last year and a half. There is so much on our plate. Who can explain it so that we can rally enough people to support it?
Well, that's a great question. In terms of explaining to Joe Biden, I will mention one thing. I don't think I'm giving away any secrets. A good friend of mine, you know him, Jared Bernstein.
Very well. I love him.
He's advising Biden. I mean, doesn't mean everything Jared says, you know, Biden writes down and says, oh, I'm going to do that. But, you know, he is in the room with him on occasion. He can get some of these ideas to him. So that's a very big help in my view. In terms of, you know, the huge problems, I mean, you mentioned climate change. That's another one where open source research, I mean, my God, wouldn't it be great, you know, if we treated that the same way as the coronavirus? This is a common problem. It's not as though we have a reason that we should say, oh, we have this great way to produce clean energy, but we're not going to share it with anyone. We're going to have a patent and charge them big bucks. No, we should want this all to be open research, and we should want this to be as cheap as possible. So that means, yeah, don't have a patent monopoly. Let everyone use it.
Yeah. Well, you know,
isn't that what the oil and gas companies did, though, is they bought up the patents for renewables and didn't bring them to market so they could keep ripping us off with their...
There's some history of that. Yeah. You know, and if it were open, that would not be a possibility. So, and again, we run that risk that even not being necessarily as pernicious as trying to protect fossil fuels, but if a company has a patent that they're making a lot of money on some type of solar energy, they might be reluctant to pursue further research there just because they don't want to risk losing the value of their patent.
Unbelievable.
So can I ask you, Dean, is the universal healthcare a similar issue, the Canadian plan versus our plan? Because one thing that Republicans talk about is that in Canada, you can't get the best, the fancy surgeries, the new technology surgeons and whatever. and we get the best healthcare, but we pay for it, and they can't get it because they don't. It's similar to patents,
they won't
I think,
fund it.
Right? That we reward it economically.
There's a grain of truth to that. So if you took it, you know, say you had, you know, millions and millions of dollars, and you suffered from a rare disease, odds are you'd get better treatment in the U.S. than Canada, because, you know, if you want to go to the absolute best in the world, that won't always be true, because sometimes the best in the world's actually in Canada. But, you know, yeah, we have the Cleveland Clinic, the Mayo Clinic. You know, these are really top flight facilities that, you know, odds are, as I say, very few of us get that treatment because we don't have the, you know, I mean, if we're upper middle class and we have good insurance, you can count on reasonably good treatment. But odds are they're not going to pay for the very top, you know, so it's kind of a moot issue even for us here. But yeah, if you had.
But I mean, that's the argument, right?
Yeah,
that the free market.
It's a silly argument because, you know, yeah, if you had millions and millions of dollars, the absolute best people are more likely to be here than. Part of it's just we have 330 million.
Right. But and the other thing is, let's remember the insurance companies are the gatekeepers. They're not going to allow this. I mean, a gazillionaire doesn't need a gatekeeper. They are their gatekeeper. It's called their portfolio. You know, I may have great insurance, but even my great insurance isn't going to always let me access all those places that Dean was just talking about. And again, I want to go back to your point about coronavirus and the pandemic. It, because it is frightening all of us, we're not even accessing our cancer treatments because we're afraid to go to the hospital because of the pandemic. Yeah. So the pandemic has really opened us up to the idea of why we need to begin to look at this more accessible way of dealing with medication and everything else, because now we're all in the same boat together, and it doesn't matter how wealthy you are.
Yeah, you know, no, it's a clear case where public health is the story, because you know, you don't want to, you know, again, maybe there's this specialist you can go see and they're really great and they offer you hope and everything, but if you're too worried about leaving your house and going to the hospital and taking whatever transportation you'd have to take,
exactly.
You might get, you know, that doesn't do you any good.
Exactly. Thank you. We're calling you again. I promise. Dean Baker, I really love you. And you're explaining it now in a way that I was having a tough time going through the article, but I was gleaning more and more about, whoa, I need to rethink this. Thank you so much for writing at the New Republic. The title of his piece, Building an Economy That Works Again, a Practical Blueprint for Reform in the Wake of the Coronavirus Shutdown. The coronavirus is our opportunity, people. Let's make sure we exercise it. He is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'll grab you again, because I think this is a story that we have to keep sort of repeating and re-explaining and repeating and re-explaining, because I think that people are aware that things have to change. Then the question is it the simplest thing of having Medicare for all? Is it the simple thing? And in the end, maybe we need to look at something below that surface. And you have exposed that in your New Republic article. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
It's a pleasure.
Okay. Good seeing y'all.
Take care. Thanks, team.
This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
Yeah. soldiers and Nixon's coming. We're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming. For dead in Ohio. 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 For dead in Ohio.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Joining us for our part two is Harold Meyerson. Harold Meyerson used to be a columnist at the Washington Post. He's the editor at large at the American Prospect. I originally reached out to Harold based on a piece entitled "Our Police Problem: White Male Cops Are the Last People We Should Employ to Police Our Cities." Let me just read that second sentence again. White male cops are the last people we should employ to police our cities. That was why I called you. But, Mr. Meyerson, since we are taping this on Tuesday, because we do it by Zoom, last night, Monday night, we watched a spectacle that was even shocking for Donald Trump. And here was this peaceful protest, and then all of a sudden came the tear gas and everything, and they broke up this peaceful protest outside the White House. And who emerges but Donald Trump? And we find out that Donald Trump wants to walk through what used to have been a crowd, but it's now dispersed, to go to a church, to basically hold up a Bible upside down. And then we find out that he sort of wants to, after having a conversation with the 50 governors, implement what begins to feel like martial law. So as I'm watching this insanity last night, I thought, I'm so glad Harold's coming on. Because we're going to be talking about the police problem, I want to talk a little bit about the Trump problem.
Sure. Because
yesterday really was theater of the absurd.
Yes, I just finished writing a piece about that incredible hour yesterday, in which I think Trump broke new ground for an American president in two ways. First of all, he became the first American president to visibly demonstrate that he doesn't know how to hold a book. He was just completely uncomfortable with having to hold a book in public. Obviously, it's not holding a book is not something he is accustomed to.
Exactly.
More seriously, what I wrote was kind of a off the top of my head history of the circumstances under which presidents have in the past either called out the army or declined to call out the army. In the 19th century, it was common for sort of business conservative presidents to call out the army when there was a strike that was more than local. So the two great railroad strikes of 1877 and 1894. In the 20th century, there have been other instances. There have actually been instances. I thought of three where presidents called out the army to enforce more equal rights when local governments wouldn't do it. The first being the riots in New York City in 1863, which started as an anti-draft riot, but soon became mass lynching of African Americans. So Lincoln sent in some army then. Secondly, though we don't really think of it as a mass sort of thing, probably one of the two moral high points of Dwight Eisenhower's presidency, when he sent in one of the airborne divisions just to help nine little black kids integrate Little Rock, Arkansas schools safely. And then most prominently, and this has been the subject of a lot of recent history, including Ron Chernow's biography of Ulysses Grant, Grant kept deploying the army in the South during his presidency, not during the Civil War, during his presidency, to enforce Reconstruction and suppress the Ku Klux Klan. And Grant did it even though he realized this was unpopular, not only in the white South, but in the white North. But he did it, you know, sort of in the face of knowing that if he was doing political calculation, this wouldn't be a good idea. What's so interesting and disquieting and disheartening and dangerous about what Trump said yesterday in his own kind of crazy offhanded way, is that he is sending in the army entirely for political calculation. This is his way of showing he's a tough guy, and all these Democratic governors and mayors are just a bunch of wusses. So, I mean, it's dangerous, it's absurd, and it is so patently political that he has broken new ground on the subject of why you would send in the army, as just as clearly as he broke new ground on being the first president who can't hold a book.
So, you know, as I'm listening to you, I mean, Donald Trump so desperately wants to turn the page. He wants to turn the page off of unemployment. He wants to turn the page off of COVID. And he's also beginning to look at the numbers. And the numbers are suggesting that older Americans who he thought he had in his pocket are now leaving him, okay? Yeah. And they're leaving him in part because they're expendable. You know, they're dying in nursing homes. They're over 65. They have a greater likelihood of dying of the pandemic. And he's so screwed up the pandemic. They're not worried about jobs as much as they're worried about living, all right?
They're worried about living. And there's also, if I may, Trump's crusade against voting by mail also threatens older Americans because they don't want to go out to polling places where they're more susceptible to COVID-19 than other people. And here he is trying to limit voting by mail, which is how the majority of older Americans, regardless of their political orientation, want to vote. So, I mean, he's you know, and this is having the effect of having Joe Biden take the lead in Florida, among other things.
Except this is his rationale for, I think, what we saw the other night.
Yeah.
And that is he sees the unrest that's happening across the country in every major urban area as a way for him to sort of say, I'm going to give you the stability you're looking for. Right. This is the one thing he can do. See, he can't do this with the virus. He can't call out the army and stop the virus, all right? Right. And so, and he can't change what is happening to older Americans who are dying of COVID-19. But what he can do, because he's playing into what he thinks is their headset, is that they still trust the police, unlike young people. They still have this idea that they're there to serve and to create stability. And what he is doing is he's becoming the top cop. And he's using the military as kind of his police force. And he's saying to older Americans, see all this craziness? This is why you need me. Without me, you will see your cities burning and you will have instability. And that, I think, is one of the rationales. He's trying to suck them back in, even as he's threatening their ability to vote. And frankly, basically sort of letting them be expendable because they will die of COVID-19.
You're right. And I think he's taking a lesson from what happened after previous instances of urban uprisings. Right. One reason Ronald Reagan was elected governor of California in 1966 was his coming down hard on presumably the liberal governor Pat Brown's inability to quash the Watts riots of 1965. Nixon was elected president in 68, partly because he talked tough about the wave of unrest and riots that swept cities in 1967 and 68. And in 1993, you had Rudy Giuliani, a Republican, being elected mayor of New York after some race-based killings, and Richard Reardon, a Republican, being elected mayor of Los Angeles after the 1992 Rodney King riots, two Republicans elected in heavily, heavily, heavily Democratic cities. So he's looking at that and says, well, look, if there's a white backlash from them, maybe that'll work for me too.
Okay, so what I'm saying, I see that history. Now let's talk about why that history may not apply now.
Right.
And that is because we're seeing the browning of America. We're seeing youth, and there was that poll that you included in your piece, where you actually see people under the age of 34 are dramatically distrustful of cops. And we're not talking just black
almost
young
two-thirds.
People.
Almost
right, exactly. And you have something you didn't have with in the past. And that is you have video. And this time, the video you have is beyond blatant. It's over 8 minutes. You're watching the cop who's killing this guy have his hands in his pockets on top of everything else. And you're already feeling vulnerable because of the illness. You already know that more blacks are dying as a result of the pandemic. It has pulled off the scab on all the inequality. And then you have this. And I think as a result, he may look at Nixon, he may look at Reagan, but he's got a much higher mountain to climb this time because we have things in front of us and we have a different demographic that's rising up that I think is going to make it even more difficult. And governors now who are really willing to challenge this president because he is the chaos president, the liar in chief.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that as we know, Republican elected officials walk in lockstep with him, but that's getting harder and harder. And a couple of them have, you know, Tim Scott, the one black Republican in the Senate, took issue with what Trump did yesterday. We have George Will writing a remarkable column today. He already was clearly against Trump, but he's now writing, we can't elect any Republican under these circumstances. George Will, for God's sakes, possibly America's leading conservative intellectual. It's getting harder and harder. And you're right. One of the inadvertent effects of the iPhone is police violence that would have been invisible and unrecorded, or at least not known outside of the black community, is now universally on display. And that can change public sentiment, and that has changed some a lot of public sentiment.
So, Harold,
could you comment on another change since Nixon and Reagan as well? And that is the right wing, the white nationalists, and the people that march in Charlottesville, and the people that want to see a race war, or at least want to see one race put down and a different race raised up. They are much more engaged, and there are normal working people who are engaged in the political process like never before, and they're out on the streets in their red beanies and their red jackets, you know?
Yeah, part of that. Is kind of a reaction to people stoking in a negative way what Arnie was just talking about, which is the browning of America. A lot of the white working class is economically embattled. There's no question about it. The working class generally is. And a good chunk of that white working class is prey to demagogues who say, And your enemy here is blacks and immigrants and Latinos who are changing American culture and who are taking your jobs, whether they are or not. I mean, obviously, corporations that offshore are taking their jobs, but that's not the target of the kind of demagogues. And in Trump, we have really the first president to seriously play that card, putting Reagan and Nixon and his predecessors into the minor leagues by the overtness with which he plays the white nationalist card.
But you know what's interesting to me, and I think you mentioned it in your piece, and that is that I think about all the white men with their camo and their M16s or whatever, their AK-47s, or whatever it is, and they're furious with, you know, the governor of Michigan, and they drive up with all this like heavy duty equipment to kill people because she basically wants them to wear masks, hasn't opened up fast enough, and wants them to social distance. And then you see the murder of a black guy. And what are they doing? They're carrying signs. They're wearing face masks. I haven't seen an AK-47. I haven't seen a bunch of Glocks. I mean, I almost think we need a split screen and say, Donald Trump's America. This is what they are, and this is what they're doing. This is what's happening in America to so many people because of police brutality, and notice the response. Yeah. One is weaponized, literally, and the other one has brought people together en masse to basically say, this is unjust.
Right, right. And, you know, that I think the realization of that is one of the reasons why you're seeing groups like suburban Republican women who don't really feel comfortable around a bunch of guys carrying AK-47s, but beginning to vote Democratic. We saw it in 2018 in the midterm elections. There are parts of, you know, the middle class, previously Republican voting base which are leaving the party. And you know, the other thing is, as those groups leave the party, what remains is an increasingly militant white nationalist core. So I think the eclipse of the Republicans in a lot of parts of the country is also synonymous with the qualitative, as it were, as well as quantitative decline.
So I want to go back to your original article that I had called you about, our police problem, white male cops are the last people we should employ to police our cities. And I'm thinking about the head of the police union in Minnesota, who is just so outrageous, who was, you know, at a Trump rally in 2017. And then he wrote a letter just the other day, basically supporting these cops that had murdered this guy and was defending them and saying their rights were not recognized as if they recognized the rights of the guy they killed. But you know what this reminded me of? Because there really is a problem with police unions.
Yeah,
and,
there is.
And the Republicans understand that. And when I think it was in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, remember when they were sort of taking away union rights? But they didn't take everyone's union rights away. They pushed the firefighters and the cops into one group, and then the teachers' unions and everybody else into the other. They have always massaged the kind of militaristic, you know, almost as you, in some ways, almost anti-black, where I think the cops with these unions, they don't see me as someone they want to protect. They actually see the people they want to protect as the enemy. I mean, it's sort of shocking to me. And the Republicans have massaged that divide between those unions and the rest of the unions.
Exactly.
And it sounds like if we're going to fix the police problem, we got to fix their union problem.
Well, you know, I mean, that was, as you said, that was a Scott Walker ploy. He understood the political difference and the white nationalist difference between a lot of the police unions and the rest of public employees. It does, you know, some of these police unions are affiliates of otherwise very liberal national unions. That should be an issue for them. There's one independent police union that isn't much of a union. Any national union that's headquartered in Sarasota with a large, which this union is, you wonder about. I think there needs to be some reckoning on the part of these really liberal national unions as what the hell they're doing representing police who endanger, you know, their substantial African-American members and so on. So,
But yeah, it sounds like that those unions are in part responsible for the lack of accountability.
Yes.
Because they're so powerful, because they're so marketed to by politicians, because it's important for them to be law and order. I mean, I have a story about a Democratic politician who will remain unnamed, but she was basically told on the issue of the death penalty that even though she wasn't for the death penalty, she needed to be for the death penalty because it was a good law and order thing. So they've always been able to have some sort of a stranglehold on politicians where politicians think they need to somehow genuflect to them. And then you find out by doing that, they've not only hurt themselves, they've hurt their constituents, and frankly, they've hurt the cops.
Yeah, you know, there are now some liberal politicians who are saying we won't take donations from police unions just in the last like two or three days. I think that's got to be a going trend. I'll also tell you, I edited the LA Weekly in Los Angeles at the time of the Rodney King beating, then the Rodney King riots and the aftermath. One of the things we researched at that time, it was common for the LA police chief, a long line of absolutely bigoted right-wing jerks who had been LA police chiefs, to endorse in mayoral campaigns, even though they worked for, presumably the mayor and the city. So we did some research and found out that in the other 20 largest American cities, this did not happen. And we managed to get this legally changed by city ordinance. But that's just sort of a subset of the police political problem generally. We really need to see Democratic politicians create some space between them and police unions.
So, but this is so provocative, because what you said is white male cops are the last people we should employ to police our cities. There has been a tremendous push to really sort of expand and create more opportunity for Hispanics and Blacks and women. I mean, and you know that there's been a concerted effort. So to say this, is it that they haven't succeeded in diversifying enough of the workforce, or is it that the white male cops, even if they're sort of threaded through this, they still ultimately end up sort of controlling the outcomes, the lack of accountability? And even if you have blacks and women and Hispanics in, they're feeling the need to somehow cover for the force as opposed to making sure the force is accountable.
Yeah, I think it's more the latter, because a lot of these forces have substantially integrated, but it's some of the former too. I mean, and one of the problems is, even if the recruits tend to be drawn more from women and minorities than they used to be, they are the less senior members of these police forces.
Right.
And, you know, you defer to your, you know, to your seniors. And so that can perpetuate a problem. Also, you know, if there's a, you know, two cops who work as a team, or four cops who work as a team, and one of them is sort of a belligerent jerk, the course of least resistance is to defer to the belligerent jerk. And that probably also is a factor.
And what we found out, because of the lack of accountability, you're not going to turn in the belligerent jerk because there's no consequences.
Right.
And so when then you see a history of no consequences, then you, one, tolerate the jerk. You don't expose the jerk. I mean, the most amazing thing about Chauvin, the guy that killed George Floyd, was that he had 18 complaints. Right. I mean, that to me should be a billboard. Yeah. That's the story of what happened in Minneapolis. If this was a one-off, you know, it's not that it wouldn't still be murder, but people would be, oh my God, this is so unlike this guy. But then when you begin to realize there's a pattern in practice, you have to start asking, what's wrong with the police force that this kind of guy can have 18 complaints and still be on the street?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I mean, there was, there's been some recent coverage just the last 2 days. Actually, Reuters ran a piece on this last month before any of this started, about how Supreme Court decisions have made it harder to, you know, get rid of these kinds of cops. So there's also kind of a legal framework that at the behest of some of these forces, some of these police forces, has been erected that makes it harder to get rid of them. And we need to change that legal framework.
So if you could do three things, I'm going to make you the despot of the day.
Okay.
What would you do within the city framework in order to begin to make the change that people are so desperate for? Because you want to see the police as the officer of the peace.
Yeah.
You don't want to, I mean, we're all slightly afraid of cops. I mean, let's be honest here. You know, I see the lights blowing and I'm like, did I speed? Did I do what? What do I do? But that's different than walking down a street. I'm not afraid when I walk down a street if I see a cop across the street. But in urban areas, a lot of people who are of color, they see a cop and their reaction is completely different from mine. And that's because they've been sensitized to feel that difference because they've been so harmed.
Exactly. Well, you know, you could create residence requirements, not only for a city, but for a neighborhood that, you know, 2/3 of Chicago is at the south, is in the south and west side, predominantly black and Latino neighborhoods. 2/3 of the hire should be from the black and Latino community from the south and east side. And if you live outside Chicago, go get a job in, that's wherever you live, but not there. That might be one thing. Secondly, right now, given what we know about white working class male politics, they should be the desk jockeys. And if you're gonna have police on the street, and every city has to have some police on the street, those aren't the ones I would put there. And you know, thirdly, I think that, and there was an op-ed in the New York Times on this just a couple of days ago, there are a lot of instances where police are routinely sent out that police are probably not the best servants to be sent out, that you need social workers, that you need mental health experts, and so on. So I think some combination of those and other things would go part of the way to defusing. You know, look, I mean, you know, the Trump people talk about, oh, there are these white agitators and Antifa and whatnot. You know, the white agitators who are turning, who are the providing the tinder for our cities are these white cops. That's you know, what starts these conflagrations.
Exactly right.
We can deal with that.
And also how they, what they do, these white cops, you know, you see them pushing people back with their batons and dragging people down to the streets. I mean, the police could also have a strategy that is more respectful of human beings and deals with them in a more,
but they have been trained
respectful manner.
Their knee-jerk reaction is to respond differently to a person of color than to respond to me. And I used this the other day. One of the people, I guess, had, the young man that was hunted down had looked into an empty building lot that, you know, remember the guy that was literally hunted like an animal. And
Aubrey.
The story, and let me just say something, Harold. They were taking buildings down across the street before they built a new school. Do you know what I did? I went in to take a look what was inside. I said, and I saw copies like Arnie, and I'm like, okay, and I walked away. I mean, it was exactly the same thing. I wasn't planning on stealing. I was curious, like everybody else is, and I wanted to look because I'd never been in the building. And yet I saw the cops, and there was no negative reaction from either them or from me, and this guy got hunted down. Yeah. And I think, again, it's that split screen and saying, what is different here? And the difference is the color of the skin.
Exactly, exactly.
And unbelievable. Harold Meyerson writes for the American Prospect. He's the editor at large. I always love talking to him. You gotta read his more recent piece about this sort of bizarre thing that happened the other day with the upside down Bible. But if not, you can read his other article, Our Police Problem. White male cops are the last people we should employ to police our cities. Thank you so much for joining us, Harold.
Thank you, Arnie, as always.
All right.
Thanks, Harold. Always great to talk to you.
This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Tired, 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 tired. I am the wife of a black man. The mother of a young black man. And the daughter and sister of a black man. And I'm tired of the injustice going on. Tired worrying when my son lay coming home. Oh, wondering what's going on.